Just throw some protein.
What
in
is
it,
that?
Other than the cheese inside of the pasta.
What is protein? Does
cheese, quote unquote.
Does tomato sauce have protein? Is that meat? Is that anything? No? Okay. Oh. No. Dang.
Maybe you should just pack some eggs.
Raw eggs.
Or the Justine's almond butter thing.
That's poison.
I think those are a really good idea. Or they have other kinds of... You can eat some nuts, can't you?
Yeah, but like, yes, but not at a point where like I can just consume a package of just concentrated nut butter.
I think they make some with chia seeds.
Hmm.
They're mixed. There's some other... It's not just straight nut butter.
All right, I'll look into this. Also, mm-hmm. Justine's, if you want to sponsor us, please email us at tangentialpod@gmail.com. We can talk. We'll just take product.
I could do with a couple dozen.
Yeah, it's so easy.
$2 packets.
Like, you don't even have to like give us... Well, I mean, you should give us money, maybe like $200, and then like just some product, and we'll talk about your product for like 10 episodes. That's a deal.
Deal. Verbal deal.
Let's go. So I'll just DM you our address, and then sounds great.
You know what to
Thanks,
do.
Thanks, Justine.
I'm Jules.
And I'm Nikki.
And this is Tangential. It's a show about the internet and all the things on it. Each week, Nicholas and I go through what we found most interesting in our search histories and share it with you free. This week, free. Nikki's going first.
Aw, yeah. So we went to go see First Man last week. Or over the weekend. It was over the weekend. Today is Monday.
It's on Thursday.
Oh, fuck. Okay, so last week we went to go see the film First Man, starring Canadian Ryan Gosling and directed by Damien Chazelle, known for La La Land, and I guess other stuff, but like you know him from La La Land. And it's a fun time. I wrote here in my notes, it's a Damien Chazelle joint for the whole family.
I don't know, I think kids would get kind of bored. I think that La La Land is more of his for the whole family joint. Whiplash is for the the neurotic in the family, and First Man is for the adults, I think, for sure.
Yeah. So, if you don't know what First Man is, it's a film about about Neil Armstrong. It's basically a biopic about Neil Armstrong. And his journey to the moon, that one time he went to the moon in 1970, whenever, 60, 73, 7, who knows? It's really impossible
to
know.
We should really, we really should have checked before this airs.
Hold on. Hey, Google, when did we go to the moon?
1969.
All right. Okay, thanks. Okay, thank you.
She's still going.
Okay. 1969 is what Google says when we went to the moon. That's the year my mom was born. Wow.
My mom as well.
Wow. Cool. Anyway, it's a story about loneliness, which is not like I legitimately didn't look into this film at all before I went to go see it, and I would have enjoyed it anyway. I like space, and I like space movies a lot. Like my favorite set of films is the documentary Star Wars. So I think the thing that like surprised me the most is that like I didn't expect for it to be a character piece, which when I then realized
because you
like,
didn't see the tagline where it said biopic. Or...
No. Oh, is it say that on the poster? Woof. Woof. I just thought it was about the Apollo program, and it would just like was about like Neil Armstrong kind of tangentially, but no, it was just about him, which was really cool because it painted a picture of Neil Armstrong that I did not know existed, mainly because the only thing I knew Neil Armstrong for was the fact that he stepped on the moon first. So getting some background was pretty cool.
I'm really interested in reading the biography, actually.
Yeah.
I think that could provide even more insight on him, because he was a man of few words. So he even refused to do, in his later years of life, he refused to do dozens and dozens of interviews and would only interview with people that he personally liked. So the only people that really know Neil Armstrong are a handful of authors and his kids.
And noted and Canadian.
His wife died last summer, I think.
Damn.
Noted Canadian Ryan Gosling actually spent a lot of time with his kids.
Yeah,
so I guess
I did
he
read
does.
That.
Mm, yeah.
People were mad. So there was a lot of hullabaloo around this film because people did not think it was American enough, which is a fucking bonkers thing to say about a film about NASA and the Apollo program, considering what it is and what it was. But people were also mad that they didn't pick an American to play Neil Armstrong. They were mad that because Rygos is Canadian, he shouldn't have gotten the role.
People aren't mad about Henry Cavill or freaking Tom Holland for playing Spider-Man.
I think
Henry Cavill for playing Superman.
I think it's just politically cool now to not like Canada.
I think that's been politically cool for like 10 years when people would just make fun of Canadians for no reason.
But that was lighthearted fun. We all
No,
were,
it wasn't. It was kind of rude.
But like we all
were like, "Oh, you're a Canadian."
Deep down in our hearts though, I think we thought and understood that they didn't have to pay for medicine. Therefore they were already better than us. But now I think that because they have the leader that we think we should have, there's like a general animosity for Canada from the left, and then on the right they just hate Canada because they think they're socialist. So like
socialism,
you can't win. But yeah, we went to go see the movie, and then I immediately went home and like the next day started to like look up stuff about the Apollo program, and I like Jules and I were talking about it the next day, and I all kind of offhandedly was like, I wonder what the mental health considerations were surrounding the like early parts of NASA.
You should paint the picture of what happens in the movie, because I don't think people actually.
Yeah, that's what I was like just about to ask. If
the isolation aspect.
Yeah, if you haven't seen the movie and want to go in blind, which is the way I went in and I really enjoyed it, just skip ahead. I'll put like a thing in the thing you can click on. But just skip ahead because I'm going to talk about some like very key plot points. So in the movie, it opens up with Neil Armstrong and his daughter who has a brain tumor. And quick aside, they show the MRI machine or like whatever it is. Or I think it might be like the chemo machine. I don't know what it is. But it looks like a space gun with this huge crystalline triangle that they just point directly at the child's head. And I looked at
it's
it. And was I looked at it and was extremely confused.
Upside
and
down.
Then I didn't think that anyone else noticed, but then Jules afterwards was like, yo, what was that big machine?
Was that
at the
how
beginning?
Lobotomies were performed in the 60s?
It was
I had
wild.
No idea what was happening until they started talking about cancer afterwards.
And then I was like, oh, that, okay. Anyway, so she dies. She passes away because of the brain tumor.
Karen.
Yeah, Karen. And then obviously that fucks people up because a child died. And they lost their daughter. And
their only daughter.
Yes. And then a couple of months later, I think. Yeah, it isn't very long between Karen passing away and then Neil accepting an offer to move to Florida for the Apollo program. Or maybe it was Houston. Impossible to know. They moved to basically
sure it's, Houston.
It's Houston. They moved
because Houston. Because
Houston.
Have a problem.
Yeah. NASA has a lot of bases in a lot of places. Okay. Where was I? You're much better at this. Can you pick up
from where?
From start at the interview part where the guy is like, just what about your dead daughter?
Right. So they ask Rygod about this, and Neil says it's not a factor. His daughter died. What of it? He was going to use all that was inside of him to get to the moon and get this done. Like, he had a goal, and he was here for it. He wanted to go to space. And he kind of compartmentalizes that death in the back of his brain. And it only pops up in these weird moments during his training. I'm not sure if you wanted to get into any of that.
But, oh, I mean, he just basically just sees, like, ghost versions of his daughter sometimes. Like,
and I'm not sure if that was creative license or if that's something Neil talked with the biographer about thinking about his daughter frequently, because it seemed like he never really talked to any of his family about Karen, even though it seemed outwardly that it had affected him in some form.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously the process of us, and by us I mean America, getting into space was a lot of, we're just going to throw a lot of money at this, and for sure a bunch of people are going to die along the way. I think this movie did a really good job of painting over how quickly NASA moved on from the people who died.
From each death.
Yeah. Because there's no time for mourning. Like, there are multiple funerals in this movie, and the longest one is for Karen. Like, the longest scene involving the funeral is Karen. But a bunch of people die. At least 6 other astronauts die, I think.
And the only one to keep the mentality that NASA as an organization had regarding the deaths was Buzz Aldrin. He kind of was just able to keep this mentality that we're doing everything for the greater good, and if you're stupid, you die, or if someone does something stupid,
it's and, just part of the process.
Messes up, you signed on for this.
Which is just which is just, that was NASA's MO, and just now talking about it is like what made me realize that, like, the movie does not let you sit. It does not want to sit on any of those people who passed away, because no one sat on that
except for their families,
right?
And
exactly.
And the movie definitely shows how the families of these men were not able to move on in the way that everyone else around them had
to.
And Neil's wife especially, who was part of the astronaut wife kind of club. She was part of the club.
Yeah.
She was seeing her friends' husbands die left and right. And, of course, her attitudes towards the space program changed drastically over time. Even though she was wholly supportive of her husband and his ambitions, there was so many opportunities for Neil to be killed.
Yeah.
And for her to be left with 2 kids to raise by herself.
Yeah.
And then the other aspect that takes a toll on one's mentality is just the isolation of the program itself, and how you're not allowed to talk about the things that are happening with anyone else except your fellow astronauts, and how you're preparing for being in space and only having 3 other people around you.
Yeah.
And those 3 other people may be the only other people that have seen or will ever see the things that you've seen.
Yeah.
It's just these experiences that you can't talk about.
Yeah. And then, like, entirely on top of that, like, you're the only ones up there. Like, at a certain point, assuming you don't die on your way up there, you're then up there, and then, like, then what? Like, you can't change your mind and come back.
Hi. Sorry.
No, you're fine. Like, you can't change your mind and come back. Like, you have to do the thing. So, like, I don't know. It was wild.
And on top of that, Neil was an extremely reserved man who didn't like talking in general.
Yeah.
So, talking or having a relationship with Neil as Neil's wife, Janet, was extremely infuriating. And it led to their demise, as you see in the film.
Yeah.
Specifically in the last scene.
The last scene is bonkers. I was so mad. Like, I was angry, and then
it
had
to end the way it did.
Yeah, definitely. But I was like, oh, fuck you, dude. Like, come on. Come on, my guy.
I totally understand why he wasn't able to.
No, for sure. But, like, I think, I don't know. I get it. I'm not saying that, like, oh, he was obligated to say some words. But, right. Like, there was a part of his brain that knew, that 100% knew that, like, he was supposed to say something, and he couldn't even, like, be like, I don't know what to say, which would have been better.
But he's never a man to talk unless he has to. Yeah. And the imagery of that scene is even more fantastic because he's in a month-long incubation or isolation to see if he has contracted any diseases from the moon, which, I mean, they hadn't been there before. Oh, I think it's a valid...
That's the thing I was actually going to talk about, so we'll get there.
He has this glass barrier between him and his wife, and it's as if the barrier didn't even need to be there because they wouldn't have talked to each other anyway. And it's at this point that Janet has given up as well. If he's not going to talk, she's not going to talk. She doesn't have to.
Yeah.
And I think that it's very rare that a movie is made about something as magnificent or groundbreaking as going to the moon or like the Titanic sinking, some monumental pieces of history where the characters are as fleshed out as the story. And Neil Armstrong's a man that we don't know a lot about, and that this movie really tried its hardest to flesh out.
Yeah.
And I just really appreciated the character development and how it wasn't thrown under the bus.
Yeah, and like I think the biggest thing for me that like put all of that into context was I didn't realize this is a movie about the space race. It is a movie about Gemini and Apollo and us the U.S. like in competition militaristically about getting into space. This movie does not address the fact that JFK, the person who was most staunchly in support of NASA at the federal level, died in the middle of like this entire process. The movie does not touch that at all. And I was like, oh, because it like didn't matter because NASA was gonna go anyway and the US government was gonna go anyway. Like it wasn't really that important.
I think that's interesting because I think the case has been made in so many movies that the final legs of the program were pushed that much further because America was such in a dark, dark place when our president had died. It's an event comparable to 9/11 where like the idea of the American dream is completely disassembled and people don't know what to do with themselves for a period of time because they're not safe.
Yeah.
And you don't feel safe. But this movie, for as patriotic as it was, chose to focus on going to the moon as a human achievement as opposed to an American achievement. Mm-hmm. And I'm not mad at it.
No.
For doing so.
Wait, can we go back 2 seconds? I kind of want to unpack the thing you just said because it is bonkers. Not like the thing that you said is like bonkers and like I don't agree with it, but like the solution that the U.S. he in one time was like, we go to the moon not because it's easy but because it is hard. He says that one time in a speech, and then presumably like he like is involved with the creation of NASA because Russia is doing space stuff. But it's wild to me that the U.S. government's reaction to national crisis was, oh, we can turn
you're gonna kill
this.
Our president, we're gonna go to the moon.
Yeah,
so what are you gonna do now?
Yeah, that is wild. And like, we're gonna go to the moon basically just to tell you, Russia, that we can go to the moon, which basically means there's like they're missing a lot of steps in here, but they're like, mm-hmm. we can go to the moon, but basically that means we can send missiles via space, which was like the
it's
middle
totally
bit.
A pissing contest.
Yeah,
let it not fool anyone.
Anyway, so the thing I wanted to actually talk about was that it basically the I wanted to specifically talk about Apollo 10 very quickly, because I found a paper that was published by someone, like a doctor who worked at NASA. His name was Dr. Charles Barry, the president of the University of Texas Health Science at Houston. And I'm just going to read this sentence. Apollo 10 was the first Apollo mission during which no in-flight illness occurred. While there was still no highly structured pre-flight preventative medicine program, illness was kept in check. So you mean to tell me that you were like, oh, we're going to send people to space, but didn't think about the fact that these people should probably be healthy before you put them in a metal box into the radiation zone? Like, that wasn't a thing you thought about? Like, that
they
is
were like,
wild.
It's not like going to war.
That is wild. Anyway, NASA's wild. Like conceptually, like the fact that NASA exists is bonkers to me. I don't know. Go see First Man.
Something I'm interested about is if the tests done on astronauts after they've come back home in relation to their mental health, mm-hmm. whether those kind of exit interviews are comparable to those given to war vets, or if there's any kind of similar process when war vets are being discharged.
Yeah. If it's like
or if
trauma?
It was similar then. Yeah.
Yeah. I do
if
know.
If anyone took interest in that.
Yeah, like I do know, but like in the 60s and 70s, almost definitely not, just because it was a bunch of men.
On the war side of things, but I think there was an interest on the astronaut side, on the Earth side of things, yeah. But I think in the space side of things, people were interested in seeing the psychological effects of space as opposed to seeing the violence and gore of human interaction on land, which is also...
So I scrolled further down in this paper, wild. And there's a header titled Psychological Issues, and I will read a paragraph. Several astronauts had some rather well-publicized difficulties in the psychological sphere after flight. Astronaut Aldrin was clinically depressed after his mission. By his own account, the largest factor
That's
contributing
so
to this depression was difficulty in handling public exposure after Apollo 11. Further,
and he was so charismatic in front of cameras all the time.
Such a
before.
Jackwagon in person, too. Like, further, he had expected that the landing of men on the moon would have tremendous impact on the world. He was extremely distressed to find that the world did not change appreciably, and certainly not immediately, as a result of Apollo 11.
Like, because you went there, and now what?
Yeah, to it's what end? Like, that was like kind of the thing I was like trying to get at when you were saying that like it was a 9/11 style, like Kennedy's assassination was 100% a 9/11 style event, which means that the result of that was okay. We're going to do this thing once, and our successor to that was we're just going to enter a forever war. Like, it's just wild to
right.
me.
And I think something the movie captured was that as proud as Neil may have been about his accomplishments, he knew that his life was on Earth and that he'd have to come back down.
Yeah.
And that even though they were at the moon, it seems like the center of the universe was the Earth.
Yeah.
Which is our humanistic narcissism, but also it was the brightest thing.
And for like at
literally.
Least, and for at least like 200
hundreds
years.
Hundreds of miles.
And at least for like 200 years, people just thought that the Earth was the center of the universe anyway. So like, as Bailey,
and he confirmed it on the moon.
It was all he could see. Yeah, go see First Man. It's a good time. Also, that movie... it like the texture of that movie is like it makes me so happy in a way that like I struggle to describe it, but like you can feel that movie with your eyes is I guess the sentence that I will
it couldn't
will
look
say.
More 60s if it yeah. tried.
It was so good. My car is making a real weird noise when I turn slowly when I like point the wheel to the right
or a shocks thing
it
or?
Is apparently I've done some googling it is a bearing issue which
oh right
so
you
the
told me.
Yeah the bearings so, like they connect The bearings, I'm not 100% sure about this, but from my understanding and looking at one or two pictures, the bearing is the thing that basically sits in between the wheel and the axle and allows the wheel to actually spin. So it converts the, since my car is a front wheel drive car, the drivetrain is in the front and then it is like pushing sideways and then something happens and then it makes the wheels go forward or backward. And then the bearing is the thing that lets the wheels actually spin freely, without like any sort of resistance. And those kind of, those are not supposed to fall apart or break down. But then I was like, it says over the lifetime of the vehicle, which I was like, this car only has like 50,000 miles on it. And then I was like, oh, people put 50,000 miles on a car in a year. And this car is 18 years old. Or 16 years old. So like it is past the lifetime. So like the fact that like parts are now starting to like become not the happiest is should not be surprising to me, but it is. How's your driving coming along?
It's happening.
Oh,
I don't think the mic picked that up. It's happening.
The
goal is to get it before Christmas.
Okay, I was gonna say, like, do you feel like if you were asked to take the exam tomorrow, you'd
no, be able but to by do it? Christmas. Yeah. And hopefully I might
have a car.
Be given a car by then.
Hell yeah. So yeah, there's that. Cars are a lot. It's like a lot of things. It's just a process. The last thing is about the opposite of a car, a train. So have you heard about...
Is that the opposite of a car? I think...
If you're
in the realm of transportation, yes, then maybe.
If you're thinking about public transit, which is what I'm thinking about,
oh,
cars.
No,
are
I'd go airplane or I'd go submarine. So I feel like.
But like a sub.
Just uncomplete. Like if this was an SAT question, it would be cat is to dog as car is to
train.
I don't think it would be train. I don't think it would be train. I think that would be one of the options.
Is to
but
street
I think plane,
car.
Plane might be better. Maybe.
Anyway, have you heard about the Purple Line and Beverly Hills's
I've heard of it.
Lack of the Purple Line or Beverly Hills?
Both. Both are equally mythological.
So the Purple Line, if you are not familiar with the Los Angeles Metro, which no fault if you even live here and aren't familiar with it, is one of two subway lines in the city. There are only two subway lines here. We have the Red and the Purple Line. And the Purple Line is currently getting extended. And I'm going to put a map in the link in the link box, because I'm not going to like me trying to break down the streets by which they're extending the Purple Line is not good audio. But if you're curious, you can go into the linked up and click it. But basically they are extending it, and a part of it is planned to go through Beverly Hills, which means that there will be a station, not really in Beverly Hills specifically, but just outside of Beverly Hills, closer to Century City. Like in that middle space, like on Avenue of the Stars, is like kind of where they want to put the station. And because Beverly Hills is Beverly Hills, they don't want it. So the gist that Beverly Hills, like the residents of Beverly Hills are used, like their reasoning is that they are afraid of the environment because there's a bunch of oil
violence
underneath.
Oh,
well, yeah,
oh.
That's the real thing, but which we'll get to. But like they're saying that because there's oil and natural gas under the high school, which is like directly where, like, that's the route for the train, they tunnel underneath Beverly and then cut back up the mountain to get to the station. They are like, if you dig a tunnel underneath the school, then like it could explode and kill all the kids at the school, which is horseshit, because Metro spent like tens of millions of dollars doing studies to figure out if whether like whether or not digging a tunnel would blow up the school, and a bunch of scientists were like, no, like that's not how that works, y'all will be fine, dig the hole. But because Beverly Hills is Beverly Hills, and they don't want to just say they don't want brown people from other parts of the city to go through this, like go through their part of the city, they are like, it's an environmental thing, even though they had a functional oil derrick on that campus for like 30 years. That was like actively taking oil out of the ground on the high school campus next to the football field. NIMBYism. It's bad. And then the end of this story is that last week Beverly Hills High School students or Beverly Hills Unified School District students did a walkout, and where a walkout in which they asked the president to remove federal funding for the entirety of the Metro project, so they could starve Metro of money so they wouldn't be able to extend the Purple Line as far, which is just infuriating to me.
The fact that they convinced the entire student body to get on board with that,
quote unquote convinced, right? Like,
I have a hard time believing that every single student was on board with
that. Oh, definitely not. Like, not the whole district did not come out, but they did drag out, like, third graders who extremely do not have strong opinions on the public transportation system. So, like,
someone probably just told them that they could blow up if this happened, and of course,
yes, they were like, that is like almost exactly what they did. Like, that has, like, it is wild to me. The wilder thing is that they, like, a handful of the teachers then had the audacity to tell journalists who were interviewing, like, they were doing their jobs and interviewing people, that they were then going to teach the kids about Rosa Parks because they were doing a nonviolent protest.
They really don't see, like, the irony.
You
they
motherfuckers.
Just don't.
Like,
they just
what?
Don't. Like, it was a bus, people.
You're doing
the bus.
It was a bus involving a black person trying to get to a part of the city. Like, what are you
Beverly Hills. That's where I wanna stay.
That was my
I
last thing.
If they lived in Beverly Hills adjacent, because
we all live Beverly Hills adjacent.
Kind of not really, because if you want to go to Beverly Hills High, there actually are like four streets that count as Beverly Hills.
They
adjacent.
Also Beverly will also send people to your house to make sure you live there.
I know,
which
I
is
know.
Wild to me. It's not even that great of a school, like. Like, it's a good
no,
school.
People just think it's a better public school than the public schools that are
around it.
It.
Yeah. I took both of my SATs there, though, so thanks, I guess.
I took mine at Marlboro.
Definitely no problems with that place. Squeaky clean. What do you got? What you got?
Me? I also did a little bit of First Man digging, but you kind of covered a lot of it. I guess the only thing that I have to add, there is a penultimate moment at the end of the film where Neil Armstrong is overlooking a moon crater and throws in a piece of jewelry that his deceased daughter Karen wore. And honestly, just felt too Hollywood to me. I had to find out if it was true or not. And I'm sure lots of people had this question because there were at least 7 articles about it. And there really is, survey says that there really is no way of proving it happened or not, because there is a documented Neil's, I don't know if it was Neil, but it's documented that Neil Armstrong, I don't know if Neil is the one who said that he did this, but it's documented that Neil stopped obeying protocol for a couple minutes and went off by himself to some part of the moon. And this is very unlike Neil, who, if you see the movie, is very methodical and
fucking
very much
nerd.
listens to what he's told and only says what he has to say. So there's really no way to find out what he did when he had his own walkout. Yeah. It is known that Buzz did leave, and other astronauts afterwards left their wives' jewelry just to have their a piece of their wife on the moon. So it's not completely outlandish to assume that Neil left something of Karen's. Yeah. But, yeah, extremely romantic and a romanticized idea. But
yeah,
there
were
who knows?
Two things about that shot. Now that you've mentioned it, that I thought
it was
were
terrifying.
Amazing. It was okay. So three things. It was terrifying. One, there's a reverse shot where Buzz Aldrin is just fucking around like 150 feet behind him. He's just bouncing
around. No, I laughed at that so
Like, Neil Armstrong is extremely sad sitting at the lip of this crater, and Buzz Aldrin is just like, doing 360 no-scopes. Like, so good.
Parkour.
But I legitimately thought that he had a golf club in, like, I thought, like, that's what that was. Because I didn't know, and I don't know what Apollo
Neil
mission.
Neil had a golf club or Buzz did?
I thought that Neil had a golf club. And, like, the thing, the reason, because the beginning of that shot, isn't it him looking straight down at the ground? And, like, all you see is his shadow. And then it moves back up, and then you realize that he's staring at a crater. I thought it was the golf thing. And then we were there for too long. And I was like, oh, this extremely isn't a man about to play golf on the moon. But, yeah. I don't even know if that was on this
mission.
Do they
make golf balls that can...
They just brought normal golf balls, and then they hit them for some reason. Like, that's what I'm... Like, that... Why? Like, they figured out they could get to the moon, and then they were like, okay, we did it. I guess we'll send more people up there and then play golf?
Next, they should bring a baseball and a baseball bat.
Yeah,
and
like,
see
what?
See how far they could hit it.
Wild.
That would have been more fun. Anyway... The other thing, so going back to how un-American people found this film, the people that most found it un-American were Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio.
Wow.
Because of the lack of, surprise, surprise, because of the lack of the American flag scene.
Oh my God.
And how it just wasn't in the film and how it wasn't highlighted as... an American achievement, and how this was one of the proudest moments in American history.
Is it?
And how it wasn't in the film.
I mean, it is.
Apparently, Buzz Aldrin was pretty upset about it as well, I think.
Oh.
But
well,
if you were to watch the movie, I think there are other things for him to be upset about.
Yeah.
So that was my bit on
for better
first
over.
Man. The only other thing that I really wanted to talk about this week was this article that I read on The Atlantic called How Instagram Saved Poetry, and it was written by Faith Hill and Karen Wan. It starts off by talking about Rupi Kaur, who I talked about, I think, a couple episodes about, and you didn't know who she was. Mm-hmm. Have you since looked her up?
Yeah, she's the one who does the dumb milk and honey poems.
Well, okay. I'm going to get into it. So, this article kind of delves into something I was talking about last week. The distinction and the boundaries there are between making a living and making art, and whether an artist can be a full-time job or whether it can't be, and that is why you are an artist, because you have that much drive to create beyond making a living from your art. The article focuses on Rupi Kaur and how she started her poetry career on Tumblr, actually, and how it just kind of ballooned from there. She's currently on Instagram. I don't know if she still posts to Tumblr. People don't really post on Tumblr anymore.
Damn.
They kind of just use it for, they kind of just use it for their own personal use, or kind of a mood board space. I know a couple photographers that actually link to their Tumblr accounts just because it kind of gives people an idea of their aesthetic and feels like the space to do that for them, apparently. I feel like there are other platforms to use, but
like, I think Tumblr's like a good halfway point between like having a website and like not having any sort of like, this is kind of who I am situation.
Correct. Yeah. You don't have to get into Squarespace and find
Squarespace, offer code tangential, type that in and save 20%.
Okay. So there was a statistic that the article site saying 12 of the 20 best-selling poets are Instagram poets worldwide as of 2018. And in the U.S., half of the poetry books that are consumed are made by social media poets. So what it really gets into is how Rupi Kaur wasn't the only person to do this. Lang Leav and Cleo Wade were also part of the poetry, social media, I don't know what to call it, I think boom. Previously, the poetry world, and honestly the literature world, had been divided into two tracks that were hard to get into and weren't very welcoming to people of color and women specifically, women and women of color. And people of color in general. The MFA track and the New York City publishing track were the only two ways to break in as a poet.
Right.
And if you didn't go about that, there was no way for you to become a poet or for your work to be seen by anyone else. So when this third track came along, social media, it broke those boundaries. And suddenly poets didn't have to have come from a background of poetry. They didn't have to be trained in any kind of way. They could just create every day, and their work could be seen by millions of people for free. And I guess critics of this form of, I wouldn't say form of poetry, it's all poetry, but of this track, say that it's more geared towards marketing and advertisement slogans. Rebecca Watts, a poet, says that social media poetry is artless poetry that sells. And it's more of a personality, an internet personality, than an actual poet's voice.
Right.
So, like, think of, I guess, like, Alexis Ren, if she were to write poetry. It's trendy, it's profiting on popular thoughts of the time.
Yeah, it's co-opting
in a meme space.
I was saying it's like co-opting the image of being an artist while doing the least to create.
Well, that's what Rebecca Watts argues.
Right.
But I think you can't deny that it's just accessible, downright accessible.
Yeah.
The act of getting an agent and being represented is an extremely stressful and awful thing for many writers. Tons of writers get lost in the MFA track and their work never gets discovered, even though they've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on education and on studying other poets. I think something that's most interesting about social media poetry is that it is marketable. And I guess what Rebecca Watts is arguing is that this poetry is being driven by deals with Nike and campaigns with Gucci, as opposed to just writing for writing's sake, art for art's sake.
But, like, I extremely don't agree, which I think is where you are also sitting, because that is how art has worked. Like, that's patronage. Like, I mean, it is
exactly.
it is a different form of patronage because we
where
live
you don't have to
a,
give money, you can just give your
yeah.
eyeballs.
Yeah, like we live in a capitalistic hellscape, but that is still at its core, that is what patronage is. Like, these people are taking sponsorship to create art, and like, you can't art is inherently classist because of the way that the world is, because the world is classist, and
mm-hmm.
art reflects the world we live in. But like having conversations around like the people who have become famous because they were good at A, gaming Instagram or gaming social media, and B, their poetry was, like you said, it is resonant enough that people love it and like are into poetry and can legitimately say that they are into poetry. Like, that is not, like, you can't downplay that. Because it is still the art form. I think people are just pissy that, like, that is... They don't want to also be considered in the same bucket as those people. Not for any other reason, but because they're kind of, like... I don't know. it's a gatekeeping thing. Like, they don't feel like they earned it.
For sure.
Even though, like, the terms by which you, quote, earn it have changed.
It's just like YouTubers and their break into film and television, and how people are upset about that acting track, or about Instagram models and how they just get to be models without having to go to, like, Kendall Jenner and Gigi Hadid, how they use their social media to get to the point that they're at.
Right.
However, there is a lot of bad social media poetry.
Yes.
But there's also a lot of bad print poetry. Yeah. And actually, this social media poetry is being printed and people are still buying it.
Yeah, people buy bad shit all the time.
So I think what Rebecca Watts was further arguing was that the reader is dead. And that people...
Oh, shit. I can't believe I died.
And that she's saying that we equate things that are marketable with art, and how they're not always one and the same, and how we're equating trends with art as well. I think that's interesting to talk about, because things that are trendy aren't always things that can be marketable.
Right. But I think, like, that is... Okay, so...
Speak.
I'm trying to like figure out how I'm gonna start this conversation about neoliberalism, because that is what this broader conversation is about. Because when the NEA and the NEH, the Natural Endowment for the Arts and Humanities, respectively, were killed in the 1980s, they still exist. They are kind of what powers the Fulbright program and a bunch of other programs that, like, very much still exist. But they were kneecapped in the 80s at the peak of what people would call, like, traditional conservatism, because there was no... It was viewed that there was no reason for the government to subsidize these things, because that was socialist. So let the capitalistic entities, like your Nikes, like your Gucci's or whatever, let them do that work. And I think, like, that what she's saying is, like, very much a critique on neoliberalism. But, like, the thing that you that is, like, hard to tiptoe around is that, like, art
who
is
has good taste and
right,
who has
exactly.
bad taste.
Like, art is still art, and you are making a decision on who you think has good taste and who has bad taste, which is, like, not a thing that anyone can do, because, like, it means something to them. Therefore, like, and no one is being hurt by it. Like, so it means something to them that makes it valid. So, like, you can't be then the person that is like, yeah, but that's shitty. Like, even though, I mean, like, I do it all the time. Like, everybody does it.
People do with that music. People yeah. do that with movies. People do that with any kind of art.
Definitely.
Because it's so subjective, and that's what it's there for. It's there to be criticized. It's there to be cherished. It's there to be judged.
Yeah.
And we should judge it. We should question things. We shouldn't just consume.
Right.
And maybe that's what Rebecca Watts is arguing, that we're not questioning what we consume when poetry and marketing become synonymous.
Definitely. Yeah. Like the scrutiny, like the, I think, like, the immediate analogy that came into my brain was, like, the scrutiny that you put onto prestige films, as, like, the capital P prestige films, that are part of
it's
the circuit.
It's prestige season, y'all.
Yeah, wow. Like, the scrutiny that those get only get that because the people who are scrutinizing them think that they're worth scrutinizing.
Those directors are worth their time.
Yeah. And, like,
those
you
writers
don't...
are worth their time. Those actors are worth their time.
Exactly. Yeah. And, like, you're not scrutinizing the movies that, quote, the people watch because it's not worth it. Like, the people...
Well, I'm talking about other, like, even in the indie sector, people, not a bunch of people get to watch those, and those don't even get scrutinized in the same way.
Right, but, like, I guess I was just talking about, like the broad strokes. Like, people were mad when, like, the thing, I guess the example I'm thinking of is that people were mad when the Oscars announced that popular film category, which I think was, like, a bad way to approach the whole thing, like, to kind of circumvent the process by being like, you guys can go over here.
It's just because we don't know what popular means.
Exactly.
Does it mean box office sales, or does it mean this is the category for people of color who were not going to
ever be in a prestige film anyway? So like, but they were going to be in a movie that was like consumable and appealed to the actual populace. Like that's the conversation that you start to have around like what it means to like class art.
I think that people have widely said that if the popular category existed last year, what they assume to have been the winner was Jordan Peele's Get Out.
Yes.
And it's immediately problematic for me. I don't know.
Wait, what won last year? I don't know.
For best film?
Yeah. Cool.
I don't remember.
Hey, Google.
What came out last year?
What won Best Picture in 2017?
The 2017 Academy Award for Best Picture winner is Moonlight.
Oh, Moonlight.
No, it's 2018.
Hey, Google. What won Best Picture in 2018?
The 2018 Academy Award for Best Picture winner is The Shape of Water.
Oh, the fish fucking one.
Right, so I said that before.
Yeah. Oh.
It was more than a fish fucking movie. Everyone should watch that movie and give it actual. Exactly.
See, like I just did it. Like I just did it there. Like there's, I don't know. It's a whole. It's like a thing.
But you didn't even consume it, so it's not
true.
It's different.
I'm just shit talking to shit talk. How fun! What a fun conversation about neoliberalism we had.
Yeah.
You have anything else?
I feel like we talk about consumerism every episode.
Yeah.
Because we're just hyper aware of it when we go through our search history.
Mm-hmm. Because like at a certain point, like that is like what is driving, that drives the internet, right? Like the cycles, you have to consume in order to be up to date. And that cycle requires you to be a conscious consumer of both the stuff that you are looking at and the stuff that you are deciding is important, and then the stuff that you are deciding is not important. And like this show is us making then the executive decision on like what was the most important thing that we consumed that week, which like I don't know, like I think it's cool to like break this stuff down, but like that is I think what the core of the internet is. It's not just like you click on shit on Neopets anymore.
There weren't many ads on Neopets. Now there are.
But now there are because Viacom bought it. Like, it's all connected. Capitalism is bad.
We have no alternative.
Wait, what is it?
The Netflix series I started? Yeah. It's the Shirley Jackson novel that was made into a 10-part miniseries. I don't even know if it's a miniseries. They might go for season two. I think I saw an article that said season two.
The Haunting of Hill House?
Yes. Did you just look it up?
I did.
Yeah.
Oh, she wrote The Lottery.
She did. Glass Castle.
That story's rad.
I think. Glass Castle. That's not right.
The Lovely House? Is that what you're thinking of? The Lottery is cool because they kill a person over with rocks.
It's Hunger Games. We have always lived in the castle. The Glass Castle was something that came out with Jeremy Renner.
Holy shit. I can't believe you just broke the Hunger Games for me. Wow. It literally is just The Lottery. How did I not? Wow.
Oh, I don't know how you didn't.
I don't. Wow.
I thought that was common.
No, yeah. Yeah. Wow. Huh. Okay.
Well, happy to help.
Thanks. I think that's gonna do it for us this week. Thank you so much for listening. You can listen to this episode and every other episode what you've done at tangential.xyz or by typing tangential into your favorite pod catcher, which is what they called them in like 2008. But type it into Apple Podcasts, you'll find us. You can, as always, follow us on Twitter at Tangential Pod. You can follow me on Twitter at Godsu. You can follow Jules on Twitter at JS Klimek. And we're also on Instagram at Chasing Grayson and at JS Klimek and at Tangential Podcast. Huge thanks, as always, to Louis Zong for the use of our theme song, Blackberry Jam, off of the album Jam 2. You can find that song and all of Louis' other music over at louiszong.bandcamp.com. Justine, get at us. Sell us. Let us talk about your nut butters.
Is it money. Justine or is it Justin? I don't.
Oh, fuck. We can't. We can't not know the name of the company. Justin's. Justin's nut butter. That's gonna be a bad search.
It's
Justin.
I think it is Justin.
Shit.
I just wanted it to be Justine so badly. I wanted that so much for Justine.
We could just pretend that we did.
For her
we
to
can't
take
pronounce.
Down Justin.
No, we can just say it's French, and we just can't pronounce. Yeah, perfect. We can't pronounce Justin. So we were just saying Justine when we really meant Justin. But yeah, Justin, get at us. We'll sell your nut butters. What?
Europe and your peanut butter's not a thing in Europe.
Oh, because peanuts aren't a thing in Europe.
I think we made them.
Well, yep. That's the science. That's the lore. That's
so
white.
We actually did create the hybridization.
All right, we'll come back to that.
I mean, if I remember my third grade history correctly.
And there's no reason you wouldn't. Did you find it?
They're a groundnut.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
Well, and a legume.
Yeah, nuts or beans?
Seeds.
Nuts or beans. No. I was talking about this earlier. I'm allergic to a lot of things, but I'm allergic to many nuts. And that means I'm allergic to a lot of beans as well, because they are in the same family of plant. So like I'm allergic to black beans and kidney beans and pinto beans and stuff. So I don't like beans because they make me
feel
gross.
George Washington Carver developed hundreds of recipes for peanuts during his tenure.
But who found the peanut? Come back next week to find out when one of us Googles who found the peanut.
Bolivia, probably.
Bye.
Bye.